Swear, what then? I was afraid of me, of everything. You, Dowd, the society. I started to see plots everywhere. Suddenly the idea of your being in my bed seemed too much of a risk. I was afraid you'd smother me, or... That's ridiculous, is it? How can I be sure who you belong to?
I belong to myself.
He shook his head, his gaze going from her face up to the painting of Joshua Godolphin that hung above the bed.
How can you know that? He said. How can you be certain that what you feel for me comes from your heart?
What does it matter where it comes from? It's there. Look at me.
He refused her demand, his eyes still fixed on the mad lord.
He's dead, she said.
But his legacy...
Fuck his legacy, she said,
and suddenly got to her feet, taking hold of the portrait by its heavy, gilded frame and wrenching it from the wall. Oscar rose to protest, but her vehemence carried the day. The picture came from its hooks with a single pull, and she summarily pitched it across the room. Then she dropped back onto the bed in front of Oscar.
He's dead and gone, she said. He can't judge us. He can't control us. Whatever it is we feel for each other, and I don't pretend to know what it is, it's ours.
She put her hands to his face, her fingers woven with his beard.
Let go of the fears, she said. Take hold of me instead.
He put his arms around her.
You're going to take me to Isorderex, Oscar. Not in a week's time. Not in a few days. Tomorrow. I want to go tomorrow. Or else,
her hands dropped from his face,
let me go now, out of here, out of your life. I won't be your prisoner, Oscar. Maybe his mistresses put up with that, but I won't. I'll kill myself before I'll let you lock me up again.
She said all of this dry-eyed. Simple sentiments, simply put. He took hold of her hands and raised them to his cheeks again, as if inviting her to possess him. His face was full of tiny creases she'd not seen before, and they were wet with tears.
"We'll go," he said.
3. There was a balmy rain falling as they left London the next day, but by the time they'd reached the estate the sun was breaking through and the parkland gleamed around them as they entered. They didn't make any detours to the house, but headed straight to the copse that concealed the retreat. There was a breeze in the branches, and they flickered with light leaves. The smell of life was everywhere, stirring her blood for the journey ahead. Oscar had advised her to dress with an eye to practicality and warmth. The city, he said, was subject to rapid and radical shifts in temperature, depending on the direction of the wind. If it came off the desert, the heat in the streets could bake the flesh like unleavened bread. And if it swung and came off the ocean, it brought marrow-chilling fogs and sudden frosts. None of this daunted her, of course. She was ready for this adventure as for no other in her life.
"I know I've gone on endlessly about how dangerous the city's become," Oscar said as they ducked beneath the low-slung branches, "and you're tired of hearing about it, but this isn't a civilized city, Judith. About the only man I trust there is Peckable. If for any reason we were to be separated... or if anything were to happen to me, you can rely upon him for help."
"I understand."
Oscar stopped to admire the pretty scene ahead, dappled sunlight falling on the pale walls and dome of the retreat.
"You know, I used only to come here at night," he said. "I thought that was the sacred time, when magic had the strongest hold. But it's not true. Midnight mass and moonlight is fine. But miracles are here at noon as well. Just as strong. Just as strange."
He looked up at the canopy of trees.
"Sometimes you have to go away from the world to see the world," he said. "I went to Isorderex a few years back and stayed, oh, I don't know, 2 months. Maybe 2 and a half, and when I came back to the 5th, I saw it like a child. I swear, like a child. This trip won't just show you other dominions. If we get back safe and sound,
we will.
Such faith. If we do, this world will be different too. Everything changes after this, because you'll be changed.
So be it, she said.
She took hold of his hand and they started towards the retreat. Something made her uneasy, however. Not his words. His talk of change had only excited her, but the hush between them, perhaps, which was suddenly deep.
Is there something wrong?
He said, feeling her grip tighten.
The silence.
There's always an odd atmosphere here. I felt it before. A lot of fine souls died here, of course.
At the reconciliation?
You know about that, do you?
From Clara. It was 200 years ago this midsummer, she said. Perhaps the spirits are coming back to see if someone's going to try again.
He stopped, tugging on her arm.
Don't talk about it, even in jest. Please. There'll be no reconciliation this summer or any other. The maestros are dead. The whole thing's...
All right, she said. Calm down. I won't mention it again.
After this summer, it'll be academic anyway,
he said with a feigned lightness.
At least for another couple of centuries. I'll be dead and buried long before this hoopla starts again. I've got my plot, you know. I chose it with Peckable. It's on the edge of the desert with a fine view of Isordrex.
His nervous babble concealed the quiet until they reached the door. Then he let it drop. She was glad he was silent. The place deserved reverence. Standing at the step, it wasn't difficult to believe phantoms gathered here. The dead of centuries past, mingling with those she'd last seen living on this very spot. Charlie for one, of course. Coaxing her inside. Telling her with a smile that the place was nothing special, just stone. And the voiders, too, one burned, one skinned, both haunting the threshold.
Unless you see any just impediment, Oscar said, I think we should do this.
He led her inside to the middle of the mosaic.
When the time comes, he said, we have to hold on to each other. Even if you think there's nothing to hold on to, there is. It's just changed for a time. I don't want to lose you between here and there. The Inovo's no place to go wandering.
You won't lose me, she said.
He went down on his haunches and dug into the mosaic, pulling from the pattern a dozen or so pieces of pyramidal stone the size of 2 fists, which had been so designed as to be virtually invisible when set in their places.
I don't fully understand the mechanisms that carry us over, he said as he worked. I'm not sure anybody does completely. But according to Peckable, there's a sort of common language into which anybody can be translated, and all the processes of magic involve this translation.
He was laying the stones around the edge of the circle as he spoke, the arrangement seemingly arbitrary.
Once matter and spirit are in the same language, one can influence the other in any number of ways. Flesh and bone can be transformed, transcended,
or transported.
Exactly.
Drew remembered how the removal of a traveller from this world into another looked from the outside. The flesh folding upon itself, the body distorted out of all recognition.
Does it hurt? She said.
At the beginning, but not badly.
When will it begin? She said.
He stood up.
It already has, he said.
She felt it as he spoke, a pressure in her bowels and bladder, a tightness in her chest that made her catch her breath.
Breathe slowly,
he said, putting his palm against her breastbone.
Don't fight it. Just let it happen. There's no harm going to come to you.
She looked down at his hand, then beyond it to the circle that enclosed them, and out through the door of the retreat to the sunlit grass that lay just a few paces from where she stood. Close as it was, she couldn't return there. The train she'd boarded was gathering speed around her. It was too late for doubts or second thoughts. She was trapped.
It's all right,
she heard Oscar say. But it didn't feel that way at all. There was a pain in her belly so sharp it felt as though she'd been poisoned, and an ache in her head, and an itch too deep in her skin to be scratched. She looked at Oscar. Was he enduring the same discomforts? If so, he was bearing them with remarkable fortitude, smiling at her like an anaesthetist.
It'll be over soon,
he was saying,
Just hold on. It'll be over soon.
He drew her closer to him, and as he did so, she felt a tingling pass through her cells, as though a rainstorm was breaking inside her, sluicing the pain away.
Bazaar,
he said, the word more shape than sound.
Yes,
she told him, and smiling, put her lips to his, closing her eyes with pleasure as their tongues touched. The darkness behind her lids was suddenly brightened by gleaming lines, falling like meteors across her mind's eye. She lifted her lids again, but the spectacle came out of her skull, daubing Oscar's face with streaks of brightness. A dozen vivid hues picked out the furrows and creases of his skin, another dozen the geology of bone beneath, and another the lineaments of nerves and veins and vessels to the tiniest detail. Then, as though the mind interpreting them had done with its literal translation and could now rise to poetry, the layered maps of his flesh simplified. Redundancies and repetitions were discarded. The forms that emerged, so simple and so absolute that the matter they represented seemed one by comparison, and receded before them. Seeing this show, she remembered the glyph she'd imagined when she and Oscar had first made love, the spiral and curve of her pleasure laid on the velvet behind her eyes. Here was the same process again. Only the mind imagining them was the circle's mind, empowered by the stones and by the traveller's demand for passage. A motion at the door distracted her gaze, momentarily. The air around them was close to dropping its sham of sights altogether, and the scene beyond the circle was blurred, but there was enough colour in the suit of the man at the threshold for her to know him even though she couldn't make out his face. Who else but Dowd wore that absurd shade of apricot? She said his name, and though she heard no sound from her throat, Oscar understood her alarm and turned towards the door. Dowd was approaching the circle at speed, his intention perfectly clear, to hitch a ride to the Second Dominion. She'd seen the gruesome consequences of such interference before, on this very spot, and she braced herself against Oscar for the coming shock. Instead of trusting to the circle to dispatch the hanger-on, however, Oscar turned from her and went to strike Dowd. The circle's flux multiplied his violence tenfold, and the glyph of his body became an illegible scrawl, the colours dirtied in an instant. The pain she'd thought washed away swept back over her. Blood ran from her nose and into her open mouth. Her skin itched so violently she'd have brought blood to that, too, had the pain in her joints not kept her from moving. She could make no sense of the scribble in front of her until her glance caught sight of Oscar's face, smeared and raw, screaming back at her as he toppled from the circle. She reached to haul him back, despite the searing pain her motion brought, and took hold of an arm, determined that wherever they were delivered to his Isordarex or death, they'd go there together. He returned her grasp, seizing her outstretched arms and dragging himself back onto the express. As his face emerged from the blur beyond the smile, she realized her error. It was Dowd she'd hauled aboard. She let go of her hold in revulsion more than rage. His face was horribly contorted, blood streaming from eyes, ears, and nose. But the mind of passage was already working on this fresh text, preparing to translate and transport it. She had no way of breaking the process, and to leave the circle now would be certain suicide. Beyond it, the scene was blurred and darkening. But she caught sight of Oscar rising from the ground, and thanked whatever deities protected these circles that he was at least alive. He was moving towards the circle again, she saw, as though to dare its flux a second time, but it seemed he judged the train to be moving too swiftly now because he retreated, arms up over his face. Seconds later the whole scene disappeared, the sunlight at the threshold burning on for a heartbeat longer than the rest, then that too, folding away into obscurity. The only sight left to her now was the matrix of lines which were the translator's rendering of her fellow traveller. And though she despised him beyond words, she kept her eyes fixed upon them, having no other point of reference. All bodily sensation had disappeared. She didn't know if she was floating, falling, or even breathing, though she suspected she was doing none of these things. She had become a sign, transmitted between dominions, encoded in the mind of passage. The sight before her, Dowd's shimmering glyph was not secured by sight but by thought, which was the only currency valid on this trip. And now, as if her powers to purchase were increasing with familiarity, the absence around her began to gain detail. The Inn Ovo, Oscar had called this place. Its darkness swelled in a million places, their skins stretching until they gleamed and split, glutinous forms breaking out and in their turn swelling and splitting, like fruit whose seeds were sown inside each other and nourished to corruption by their predecessors' decay. Repulsive as this was, there was worse to come. As new entities appeared, these no more than scraps from a cannibal's table, sucked bloodless and gnawed, idiot doodles of life that didn't bear translation into any material form. Primitive though they were, they sensed the presence of finished life-forms in their midst, and rose towards the travellers like the damned to passing angels. But they swarmed too late. The visitors moved on and away, the darknesses sealing up their tenants and receding. Jude could see Dowd's body in the midst of his glyph, still insubstantial but brightening by the moment. With the sight, the agonies of ferriage returned, though not as sharply as those that had pained her at the outset of the journey. She was glad to have them if they proved her nerves were hers again. Surely it meant the journey was almost over. The horrors of the Inn Ovo had almost disappeared entirely when she felt the faint heat on her face. But the scent this heat raised to her nostrils brought more certain proof that the city was near, a mingling of the sweets and sours she'd first smelled on the wind that had issued from the retreat months before. She saw a smile come over Dowd's face, cracking the blood already dried on it, a smile which became a laugh, in a beat or two, ringing off the walls of the merchant Peckable's cellar as it grew solid around them. She didn't want to share his pleasure after all the harms he'd devised, but she couldn't help herself. Relief that the journey hadn't killed her, and sheer exhilaration that after all this time she was here, brought laughter onto her face and, with every breath between, the air of the Second Dominion into her lungs. Chapter 31 1 5 miles up the mountainside from the house in which Jude and Dowd were taking their first gasps of Isordorexian air, the Autarch of the Reconciled Dominions sat in one of his watchtowers and surveyed the city he had inspired to such notorious excess. It was 3 days since his return from the Quem Palace, and almost every hour somebody—it was usually Rosengarten—had brought news of further acts of civil defiance, some in regions of the Imagica so remote that word of the mutinies had been weeks in coming, some, these more disturbing, barely beyond the palace walls. As he mused, he chewed on Crouchy, a drug to which he'd been addicted for some 70 years. Its side effects were severe and unpredictable for those unused to it. Periods of lethargy alternated with bouts of priapism and psychotic hallucination. Sometimes the fingers and toes swelled to grotesque proportions. But the Autarch's system had been steeped in Crouchy for so many years, the drug no longer assaulted either his physique or his faculties, and he could enjoy its capacity to lift him from dolor without having to endure its discomforts. Or at least such had been the case until recently. Now, as if in league with the forces that were destroying his dream below, the drug refused to give him relief. He demanded a fresh supply while meditating at the place of the pivot, only to get back to his Isordorex to find that his procurers in the Scoriae Kesperate had been murdered. Their killers were reputedly members of the Dearth, an order of renegade shamists, worshippers of the Madonna, he'd heard it rumoured, who'd been fulmigating revolution for years and had until now presented so little threat to the status quo that he'd let them be for entertainment's sake. Their pamphlets, a mingling of castration fantasies and bad theology, had made farcical reading, and with their leader Athanasius in prison, many of them had retreated to the desert to worship at the margins of the First Dominion, the so-called Erasure, where the solid reality of the Second paled and faded. But Athanasius had escaped his custody and returned to his Isordorex with fresh calls to arms. His first act of defiance, it seemed, had been the slaughter of the Crouchy Pushers. A small deed, but the man was wily enough to know what an inconvenience he'd caused with it. No doubt he was touting it as an act of civil healing, performed in the name of the Madonna. The autarch spat out the wad of crouchy he was chewing and vacated the watchtower, heading off through the monumental labyrinth of the palace towards Quaiswa's quarters in the hope that she had some small supply he could filch. To left and right of him were corridors so immense no human voice would carry along them, each lined with dozens of chambers, all exquisitely finished, all exquisitely empty, the ceilings of many so high that thin clouds formed there. Though his architectural endeavours had once been the wonder of the dominions, the enormity of his ambition, and indeed of his achievement, mocked him now. He'd wasted his energies with these follies when he should have been concerning himself with the shock waves his empire-building had sent through the Imagica. It wasn't the pogroms he'd instigated that were causing these troubles, his analysts informed him. The present unrest was a consequence of less violent changes in the fabric of the dominions, the rise of Isordrex and its companion cities being one of those changes, and perhaps its most significant. All eyes had been turned towards the tinsel glories of those cities, and a new pantheon had been created for tribes and communities that had long since lost faith in the deities of rock and tree. Peasants had left their dust bowls in their hundreds of thousands to claim their slice of this miracle, only to end up fermenting their envy and despair in hellholes like Vanev. That was one way revolutionaries were made, the analysts said, not out of ideologies, but out of frustration and rage. Then there were those who saw a chance to profit by anarchy, like the new species of nomads that were making portions of the Lenten Way impassable, crazed and merciless bandits who took pleasure in their own notoriety. And finally, there were the new rich, the dynasties created by the boom in consumption that had come with Isordrex's rise. In the early days they'd repeatedly turned to the regime for protection against the acquisitive poor, but the autarch had been too busy building his palace, and the help had not been forthcoming, so the dynasties had formed private armies to police their lands, swearing their continued allegiance to the empire even as they plotted against it. Now those plots were no longer theory. With their armies primed to defend their estates, the boom barons were announcing themselves independent of Isordrex and its taxes. There was, the analysts said, no evidence of collusion among these elements. How could there be? They didn't have a single philosophical notion in common. They were neo-feudalists, neo-communists, neo-anarchists, all enemies of the others. It was purely coincidence that had roused them to rebellion at the same moment. Either that, or unfortuitous stars. The autarch barely listened to such assessments. What little pleasure he'd taken in politics at the beginning of his regime had quickly staled. It wasn't the craft he'd been born to, and he found it tiresome and dull. He'd appointed his tetrarchs to rule over the four reconciled dominions, the tetrarch of the first doing so in absentia, of course, leaving him to obsess upon making Isordrex the city to end all cities, and the palace its glorious crown. What he'd in fact created was a monument to purposelessness, which, when he was under the influence of Crouchy, he would rail against as at some enemy. One day, for instance, in visionary mood, he'd had all the windows in the chambers facing the desert smashed, and great tonnages of rancid meat laid on the mosaics. Within a day, flocks of carrion birds had forsaken the hot, high winds above the sands and were feasting and breeding on tables and beds prepared for the royalty of the dominions. In another such mood, he'd had fishes brought up from the delta and housed in the baths. The water was warm, the food plentiful, and they proved so fecund he could have walked on their backs within weeks. Then they became overcrowded, and he spent many hours watching the consequences, patricide, fratricide, infanticide. But the cruelest revenge he wreaked against his folly was the most private. One by one he was using the high halls with their drizzling clouds as stages for dramas in which nothing was feigned, not even death. And when the final act had been performed, he had each theatre sealed as elaborately as a king's tomb and moved on to another chamber. Little by little, the glorious palace of Isordrex was becoming a mausoleum. The suite of chambers he was entering now was exempt from this process, however. Quaiswa's bathrooms, bedrooms, lounges and chapel were a state unto themselves, and he'd long ago sworn to her he would never violate them. She'd decorated the rooms with any lush or luxurious item that pleased her eclectic eye. It was an aesthetic he himself had favoured before his present melancholia. He'd filled the bedrooms now nested by carrion birds with immaculate copies of Baroque and Rococo furniture, had commissioned the walls to be mirrored like Versailles, and had the toilets gilded. But he'd long since lost his taste for such extravagances, and now the very sight of Quesoir's rooms nauseated him so much that if he hadn't been driven by need, he'd have retreated, appalled by their opulence. He called his wife's name as he went, first through the lounges, strewn with the leavings of a dozen meals. All were empty. Then into the state room, which was appointed even more grandly than the lounges, but also empty. Finally, to the bedroom. At its threshold he heard the slap of feet on the marble floor, and Quesoir's servant, Concupiscentia, paddled into view. She was naked, as always, her back a field of multicoloured extremities, each as agile as an ape's tail, her forelimbs withered and boneless things, bred to such vestigial condition over generations. Her large green eyes seeped constantly, the feathery fans to either side of her face, dipping to brush the moisture from her rouged cheeks. "Where's Quesoir?" he demanded. She drew a coquettish fan of her tails over her lower face and giggled behind them like a geisha. The autarch had slept with her once, in a crouchy fugue, and the creature never let him by without a show of flirtation. "Not now, for Christ's sake," he said, disgusted at the display. "I want my wife. Where is she?" Concupiscentia shook her head, retreating from his raised voice and fist. He pushed past her into the bedroom. If there was any tiny wad of Crouchy to be had, it would be here, in her boudoir, where she lazed away so many days, listening to Concupiscentia sing hymns and lullabies. The chamber smelled like a harbour bordello, a dozen sickly perfumes draping the air like the veils that hung around the bed. "I want Crouchy," he said. "Where is it?" Again, a great shaking of the head from Concupiscentia, this time accompanied by whimpering. "Where?" he shouted. "Where?" The perfume and the veils sickened him, and he began to rip at the silks and gossamers in his rage. The creature didn't intervene until he picked up the Bible lying open on the pillows and threatened to rip out its onion leaf pages.
"Please, Hap," she squealed. "Please, Hap. She'll unbeat if ye tower at the book. Quesoir love at the book."
It wasn't often he heard the gloss, the pidgin English of the islands, and the sound of it, as misshapen as its source, infuriated him even more. He tore half a dozen pages from the Bible just to make her squeal again. She obliged.
"I want Crouchy," he said.
"I have it, I have it," the creature said,
and led him from the bedroom into the enormous dressing room that lay next door, where she began to search through the gilded boxes on Quesoir's dressing table. Catching sight of the autarch's reflection in the mirror, she made a tiny smile, like a guilty child, before bringing a package out of the smallest of the boxes. He snatched it from her fingers before she had a chance to proffer it. He knew from the smell that stung his nostrils that this was good quality, and without hesitating, he unwrapped it and put the whole wad into his mouth.
"Good girl," he told Concupiscentia. "Good girl. Now, do you know where your mistress got it?"
Concupiscentia shook her head.
"She go a lot alone, and to the Kesperit, many nights. Sometimes she'll em a goat, beggar. Sometimes she'll em goat."
"A whore?"
"No, no, Quesoir is em a whore."
"Is that where she is now?" the autarch said. "Is she out whoring?"
"It's a little early for that, isn't it?
Or is she cheaper in the afternoon?"
The Crouchy was better than he'd hoped. He felt it striking him as he spoke, lifting his melancholy and replacing it with a vehement buzz. Even though he'd not penetrated Quesoir in 4 decades, nor had any desire to, in some moods news of her infidelities could still depress him. But the drug took all that pain away. She could sleep with 50 men a day, and it wouldn't take her an inch from his side. Whether they felt contempt or passion for each other was irrelevant. History had made them indivisible, and would hold them together till the apocalypse did them part.
"She'll am not whoring,"
Concupiscentia piped up, determined to defend her mistress's honour.
"She'll am down at a scorie."
"The scorie? Why?"
"Executions,"
Concupiscentia replied, pronouncing this word, learned from her mistress's lips, perfectly.
Executions, the autark said, a vague unease surfacing through the crouchy's soothings. What executions?
Concupiscentia shook her head.
I dinner pni, she said. Just executions, all about executions. She prayat to tem—
I'm sure she does.
We all prayat for the souls, sota going tat the presence of the unbeheld washed.
Here were more phrases, repeated parrot fashion, the kind of Christian cant he found as sickening as the decor. And like the decor, these were Quasar's work. She'd embraced the Man of Sorrows only a few months ago, but it hadn't taken her long to claim she was his bride. Another infidelity. Less syphilitic than the hundreds that had gone before, but just as pathetic. The autark left Concupiscentia to babble on, and dispatched his bodyguard to locate Rosengarten. There were questions to be answered here, and quickly, or else it wouldn't only be the Scorii where heads would roll.
2. Travelling the Lenten way, Gentle had come to believe that, far from being the burden he'd expected her to be, Huzar was a blessing. If she hadn't been with them in the cradle, he was certain the goddess Tisha Lule would not have intervened on their behalf, nor would hitchhiking along the highway have been so easy if they hadn't had a winsome child to thumb rides for them. Despite the months she'd spent hidden away in the depths of the asylum, or perhaps because of them, Huzar was eager to engage everyone in conversation, and from the replies to her innocent inquiries, he and Pai gleaned a good deal of information he doubted they'd have come by otherwise. Even as they'd crossed the causeway to the city, she'd struck up a dialogue with a woman who'd happily supplied a list of the Kesperates, and even pointed out those that were visible from where they'd walked. There were too many names and directions for Gentle to hold in his head, but a glance towards Pai confirmed that the mistiff was attending closely, and would have all of them by heart by the time they reached the other side.
"Wonderful," Pai said to Huzar when the woman had departed. "I wasn't sure I'd be able to find my way back to my people's Kesperate. Now I know the way. Up through the Oke Tnun to the Karames, where they make the Autark's sweetmeats,"
Huzar said, repeating the directions as if she was reading them off a blackboard.
"Follow the wall of the Karames till we get to Smook Street, then up to the Viaticum, and we'll be able to see the gates from there."
"How do you remember all that?" Gentle said, to which Huzar somewhat disdainfully asked how he could have allowed himself to forget.
"We mustn't get lost," she said.
"We won't," Pai replied. "There'll be people in my Kesperate who'll help us find your grandparents."
"If they don't, it doesn't matter,"
Huzar said, looking gravely from Pai to Gentle.
"I'll come with you to the First Dominion. I don't mind. I'd like to see the unbeheld."
"How do you know that's where we're going?" Gentle said.
"I've heard you talking about it," she replied. "That's what you're going to do, isn't it? Don't worry. I'm not scared. We've seen a goddess, haven't we? He'll be the same, only not as beautiful."
This unflattering notion amused Gentle mightily.
"You're an angel, you know that," he said, going down on his haunches and sliding his arms around her.
She put on a few pounds in weight since they'd begun their journey together, and her hug when she returned it was strong.
"I'm hungry," she murmured in his ear.
"Then we'll find somewhere to eat," he replied. "We can't have our angel going hungry."
They walked up through the steep streets of the Oke Tnun until they were clear of the throng of itinerants coming off the causeway. Here there were any number of establishments offering breakfast, from stalls selling barbecued fish to cafes that might have been transported from the streets of Paris, but that the customers sipping coffee were more extraordinary than even that city of exotics could boast. Many were species whose peculiarities he now took for granted. Ethacs and Heretae, distant relatives of Mother Splendid and Hamrioc, even a few who resembled the one-eyed croupier from Atterboy. But for every member of a tribe whose features he recognized, there were two or three he did not. As in Vanaef, Pai had warned him that staring too hard would not be in their best interests, and he did his best not to enjoy too plainly the array of courtesies, humours, lunacies, gaits, skins, and cries that filled the streets. But it was difficult. After a time they found a small cafe from which the smell of food was particularly tempting, and Gentle sat down beside one of the windows from which he could watch the parade without drawing too much attention.
"I had a friend called Klein," he said as they ate, "back in the Fifth Dominion. He liked to ask people what they'd do if they knew they only had 3 days to live."
"Why three?" Hazar asked.
"I don't know. Why three anything? It's one of those numbers."
"In any fiction there's only ever room for three players," the Mistiff remarked. "The rest must be..."
Its flow faltered in mid-quotation.
"Agents. Something, and something else. That's a line from Pluthero Quexus." "Who's he?"
"Never mind."
"Where was I?"
"Klein,"
said Hussar.
"When he got around to asking me this question, I told him, if I had 3 days left, I'd go to New York, because you've got more chance of living out your wildest dreams there than anywhere. But now I've seen his order, X."
"Not much of it,"
Hussar pointed out.
"It's enough, Angel. If he asks me again, I'm going to tell him I'd like to die in his order, X."
"Eating breakfast with Pie and Hussar," she said.
"Perfect."
"Perfect,"
she replied, echoing his intonation precisely.
"Is there anything I couldn't find here if I looked hard enough?"
"Some peace and quiet," Pye remarked.
The hubbub from outside was certainly loud, even in the cafe.
"I'm sure we'll find some little courtyards up in the palace," Gentle said.
"Is that where we're going?"
Hussar asked.
"Now listen," said Pye. "For one thing, Mr. Zacharias doesn't know what the hell he's talking about."
"Language, Pye," Gentle put in.
"And for another, we brought you here to find your grandparents, and that's our first priority. Right, Mr. Zacharias?"
"What if you can't find them?"
Hussar said.
"We will," Pye replied. "My people know this city from top to bottom."
"Is that possible?" Gentle said. "I somehow doubt it."
"When you've finished your coffee," Pye said, "I'll allow them to prove you wrong."
With their bellies filled, they headed on through the streets, following the route they'd had laid out for them. From the Oke Tanoon to the Karames, following the wall until they reached Smook Street. In fact, the directions were not entirely reliable. Smook Street, which was a narrow thoroughfare and far emptier than those they'd left, did not lead them onto the Viaticum as they'd been told it would, but rather into a maze of buildings as plain as barracks. There were children playing in the dirt, and among them Wild Rajami, an unfortunate cross between porcine and canine strains that Gentle had seen spitted and served in Maike, but which here seemed to be treated as pets. Either the mud, the children, or the Rajami stank, and their smell had attracted Zazai in large numbers.
"We must have missed a turning," the Mistiff said. "We'd be best to—"
He stopped in mid-sentence, as the sound of shouting rose from nearby, bringing the children up out of the mud and sending them off in pursuit of its source. There was a high, unmusical holler in the midst of the din, rising and falling like a warrior cry. Before either Pye or Gentle could remark on this, Hussar was following the rest of the children, darting between the puddles and the rooting Rajami to do so. Gentle looked at Pye, who shrugged. Then they both headed after Hussar, the trail leading them down an alleyway into a broad and busy street which was emptying at an astonishing rate as pedestrians and drivers alike sought cover from whatever was racing down the hill in their direction. The hollerer came first. An armoured man of fully twice Gentle's height, carrying in each fist scarlet flags that snaked behind him as he ran, the pitch and volume of his cry undimmed by the speed at which he moved. On his heels came a battalion of similarly armoured soldiers, none even in the troop, under 8 feet tall, and behind them again a vehicle which had clearly been designed to mount and descent the ferocious slopes of the city with minimum discomfort to its passengers. The wheels were the height of the hollerer, the carriage itself low slung between them, its bodywork sleek and dark, its windows darker still. A gull had become caught between the spokes of the wheels on the way down the hill, and it flapped and bled there as the wheels turned, its screeches a wretched but perfect complement to the cacophony of wheels, engine and hollerer. Gentle took hold of Hussar as the vehicle raced past, though she was in no danger of being struck. She looked around at him, wearing a wide grin.
"Who was that?"
she said.
"I don't know."
A woman sheltering in the doorway beside them furnished the answer.
"Quesuar," she said, "the autarch's woman. There's arrests being made down in the Scorie. More deaths."
She made a small gesture with her fingers, moving them across her face from eye to eye, then down to her mouth, pressing the knuckles of first and third fingers against her nostrils, while the middle digit tugged at her lower lip. All this with the speed of one who made the sign countless times in a day. Then she turned off down the street, keeping close to the wall as she went.
"Athanasius was a dearther, wasn't he?"
Gentle said.
"We should go down and see what's happening."
"It's a little too public," Pye said.
"We'll stay to the back of the crowd," Gentle said. "I want to see how the enemy works."
Without giving Pye time to object, Gentle took Hazar's hand and headed after Quasar's troop. It wasn't a difficult trail to follow. Everywhere along the route, faces were once more appearing at windows and doors, like anemones showing themselves again after being brushed by the underbelly of a shark. Tentative, ready to hide their tender heads again at the merest sign of a shadow. Only a couple of tots, not yet educated in terror, did as the three strangers were doing and took to the middle of the street, where the comet's light was brightest. They were quickly reclaimed for the relative safety of the doorways in which their guardians hovered. The ocean came into view as the trio descended the hill, and the harbour was now visible between the houses, which were considerably older in this neighbourhood than in the OK to Noon, or up by the Karames. The air was clean and quick here. It enlivened their step. After a short while, the domestic dwellings gave way to docklands. Warehouses, cranes, and silos reared around them. But the area was by no means deserted. The workers here were not so easily cowed as the occupants of the Kesper at above, and many were leaving off their labours to see what this rumpus was all about. They were a far more homogenized group than Gentle had seen elsewhere, most a cross between Ethac and Homo sapiens, massive, even brutish men who, in sufficient numbers, could certainly trounce Quasar's battalion. Gentle hoisted Hazar up to ride on his back as they joined this congregation, fearful she'd be trampled if he didn't. A few of the dockers gave her a smile, and several stood aside to let her mount secure a better place in the crowd. By the time they came within sight of the troops again, they were thoroughly concealed. A small contingent of the soldiers had been charged to keep onlookers from straying too close to the field of action, and this they were attempting to do, but they were vastly outnumbered, and as the crowd swelled it steadily pushed the cordon towards the site of the hostilities, a warehouse some 30 yards down the street, which had apparently been laid siege to. Its walls were pitted with bullet strikes and its lower windows smoked. The besieging troops, who were not dressed showily like Quasar's battalion, but in the monochrome Gentle had seen paraded in Limby, were presently hauling bodies out of the building. Some were on the second story, pitching dead men, and a couple who still had life in them, out of the windows onto the bleeding heap below. Gentle remembered Beatrix. Was this cairn building one of the marks of the Autarch's hand?
"You shouldn't be seeing this, Angel," Gentle told Hazar, and tried to lift her off his shoulders, but she held fast, taking fistfuls of his hair as security.
"I want to see," she said. "I've seen it with Daddy lots of times."
"Just don't get sick on my head," Gentle warned.
"I won't," she said, outraged at the suggestion.
There were fresh brutalities unfolding below. A survivor had been dragged from the building and was kicked to the ground a few yards from Quasar's vehicle, the doors and windows of which were still closed. Another was defending himself as best he could from bayonet jabs, yelling in defiance as his tormentors encircled him. But everything came to a sudden halt, with the appearance on the warehouse roof of a man wearing little more than ragged underwear, who opened his arms like a soul in search of martyrdom and proceeded to harangue the assembly below.
"That's Athanasius," Pye murmured in astonishment.
The mystiff was far sharper sighted than Gentle, who had to squint hard to confirm the identification. It was indeed Father Athanasius, his beard and hair longer than ever, his hands, brow and flank running with blood.
"What the hell's he doing up there?" Gentle said. "Giving a sermon?"
Athanasius's address wasn't simply directed at the troops and their victims on the cobblestones below. He repeatedly turned his head towards the crowd, shouting in their direction too. Whether he was issuing accusations, prayers, or a call to arms, the words were lost to the wind, however. Soundless, his display looked faintly absurd, and undoubtedly suicidal. Rifles were already being raised below to put him in their sights. But before a shot could be fired, the first prisoner, who'd been kicked to his knees close to Quasar's vehicle, slipped custody. His captors, distracted by Athanasius's performance, were slow to respond, and by the time they did so, their victim was already dashing towards the crowd, ignoring quicker escape routes to do so. The crowd began to part, anticipating the man's arrival in its midst, but the troops behind him were already turning their muzzles his way. Realizing they intended to fire in the direction of the crowd, Gentle dropped to his haunches, yelling for Hussar to clamber down. This time she didn't protest. As she slipped from his shoulders, several shots were fired. He glanced up and through the mesh of bodies caught sight of Athanasius falling back as if struck, and disappearing behind the parapet around the roof.
"Damn fool,"
he said to himself, and was about to scoop Hussar up and carry her away, when a second round of shots froze him in his tracks. A bullet caught one of the dockers a yard from where he crouched, and the man went down like felled timber. Gentle looked around for Pi, rising as he did so. The escaping Dirtha had also been hit, but he was still staggering forward, heading towards a crowd that was now in confusion. Some were fleeing, some standing their ground in defiance, some going to the aid of the fallen docker. It was doubtful the Dirtha saw any of this. Though the momentum of his flight still carried him forward, his face, too young to boast a beard, was slack and expressionless, his pale eyes glazed. His lips worked as though to impart some final word, but a sharpshooter below denied him the comfort. Another bullet struck the back of his neck and appeared on the other side, where three fine blue lines were tattooed across his throat, the middle one bisecting his Adam's apple. He was thrown forward by the bullet's impact, the few men between him and Gentle parting as he fell. His body hit the ground a yard from Gentle with only a few twitches of life left in it. Though his face was to the ground, his hands still moved, making their way through the dirt towards Gentle's feet as if they knew where they were going. His left arm ran out of power before it could reach its destination, but the right had sufficient will behind it to find the scuffed toe of Gentle's shoe. He heard Pi murmuring to him from close by, coaxing him to come away, but he couldn't forsake the man, not in these last seconds. He started to stoop, intending to clasp the dying fingers in his palm, but he was too late by seconds. The arm lost its power, and the hand dropped back to the ground, lifeless.
"Now will you come?" Pi said.
Gentle tore his eyes from the corpse and looked up. The scene had gained him an audience, and there was a disturbing anticipation in their faces, puzzlement and respect, mingled with the clear expectation of some pronouncement. Gentle had none to offer and opened his arms to show himself empty-handed. The assembly stared on, unblinking, and he half thought they might assault him if he didn't speak, but a further burst of gunfire from the siege site broke the moment and the starers gave up their scrutiny, some shaking their heads as though waking from a trance. The second of the captives had been executed against the warehouse wall, and shots were now being fired into the pile of bodies to silence some survivor there. Troops had also appeared on the roof, presumably intending to pitch Athanasius's body down to crown the cairn, but they were denied that satisfaction. Either he'd faked being struck, or else he'd survived the wounding and crawled off to safety while the drama unfolded below. Whichever, he'd left his pursuers empty-handed. Three of the cordon keepers, all of whom had fled for cover as their comrades fired on the crowd, now reappeared to claim the body of the escapee. They encountered a good deal of passive resistance, however, the crowd coming between them and the dead youth, jostling them. They forced their way through with well-aimed jabs from bayonets and rifle butts, but Gentle had time to retreat from in front of the corpse as they did so. He had also had time to look back at the corpse-strewn stage, visible beyond the heads of the crowd. The door of Quasar's vehicle had opened, and with her elite guard forming a shield around her, she finally stepped out into the light of day. This was the consort of the Imagica's vilest tyrant, and Gentle lingered a dangerous moment to see what mark such intimacy with evil had made upon her. When she came into view, the sight of her, even with eyes that were far from perfect, was enough to snatch the breath from him. She was human, and a beauty. Nor was she simply any beauty. She was Judith. Pi had hold of his arm, drawing him away, but he wouldn't go.
"Look at her! Jesus! Look at her, Pi! Look!"
The mistiff glanced towards the woman.
"It's Judith," Gentle said.
That's impossible.
It is! It is! Use your fucking eyes! It's Judith!
As if his raised voice was a spark to the bone-dry rage of the crowd all around, violence suddenly erupted, its focus the trio of soldiers who were still attempting to claim the dead youth. One was bludgeoned to the ground while another retreated, firing as he did so. Escalation was instantaneous. Knives were slid from their sheaths, machetes unhooked from belts. In the space of 5 seconds, the crowd became an army, and 5 seconds later claimed its first 3 lives. Judith was eclipsed by the battle, and Gentle had little choice but to go with Pi, more for the sake of Hussar than for his own safety. He felt strangely inviolate here, as though that circle of expectant stares had lent him a charmed life.
"It was Judith, Pi," he said again,
once they were far enough from the shouts and shots to hear each other speak. Hussar had taken firm hold of his hand and swung on his arm excitedly.
"Who's Judith?"
she said.
"A woman we know,"
Gentle said.
"How could that be her?"
The mistiff's tone was as fretful as it was exasperated.
"Ask yourself, how could that be her? If you've got an answer, I'm happy to hear it. Truly I am. Tell me."
"I don't know how," Gentle said, "but I trust my eyes.
We left her in the 5th, Gentle.
If I got through, why shouldn't she?
And in the space of 2 months, she takes over as the Autarch's wife?
That's a meteoric rise, wouldn't you say?"
A fresh fusillade of shots rose from the siege site, followed by a roar of voices so profound it reverberated in the stone beneath their feet. Gentle stopped, walked, and looked back down the slope towards the harbour.
"There's going to be a revolution," he said simply.
"I think it's already begun," Pi replied.
"They'll kill her,"
he said, starting back down the hill.
"Where the hell are you going?" Pi said.
"I'm coming with you,"
Hussar piped up, but the mistiff took hold of her before she could follow.
"You're not going anywhere,"
Pi said,
"except home to your grandparents. Gentle, will you listen to me? It's not Judith."
Gentle turned to face the mistiff, attempting a reasoning tone.
"If it's not her, then it's her double. It's her echo. Some part of her, here in Isordorex."
The mistiff didn't reply. It merely studied Gentle as if coaxing him with its silence to articulate his theory more fully.
"Maybe people can be in 2 places at one time," Gentle said. Frustration made him grimace. "I know it was her, and nothing you can say is going to change my mind. You two go into the Kesperate. Wait for me. I'll—"
Before he could finish his instructions, the holler that had first announced Quasar's descent from the heights of the city was raised again, this time at a higher pitch, to be drowned out almost instantly by a surge of celebratory cheering.
"That sounds like a retreat to me," Pi said,
and was proved right 20 seconds later with the reappearance of Quasar's vehicle, surrounded by the tattered remnants of her retinue. The trio had plenty of time to step out of the path of wheels and boots as they thundered up the slope, for the pace of the retreat was not as swift as that of the advance. Not only was the ascent steep, but many of the elite had sustained wounds in defending the vehicle from assault and trailed blood as they ran.
"There's going to be such reprisals now," Pi said.
Gentle murmured his agreement as he stared up the slope where the vehicle had gone.
"I have to see her again," he said.
"That's going to be difficult," Pi replied.
"She'll see me," Gentle said. "If I know who she is, then she's going to know who I am. I'll lay money on it."
The mistiff didn't take up the bet. It simply said,
"What now?"
"We go to your Kesperate, and we send out a search party to look for Hussar's folks. Then we go up,"
he nodded towards the palace, "and get a closer look at Quasar. I've got some questions to ask her, whoever she is."
3. The wind veered as the trio retraced their steps, the relatively clear ocean breeze giving sudden way to a blisteringly hot assault off the desert. The citizens were well prepared for such climatic changes, and at the first hint of a shift in the wind, scenes of almost mechanical and therefore comical efficiency were to be seen high and low. Washing and potted plants were gathered from windowsills. Rajami and cats gave up their sun traps and headed inside. Awnings were rolled up and windows shuttered. In a matter of minutes, the street was emptied.
"I've been in these damn storms," the mistiff said. "I don't think we want to be walking about in one."
Gentle told it not to fret, and hoisting Hussar onto his shoulders, He set the pace as the storm scourged the streets. They'd asked for fresh directions a few minutes before the wind veered, and the shopkeeper who'd supplied them had known his geography. The directions were good even if walking conditions were not. The wind smelt like flatulence and carried a blinding freight of sand along with ferocious heat, but they at least had the freedom of the streets. The only individuals they glimpsed were either felonious, crazy, or homeless, into all three of which categories they themselves fell. They reached the Viaticum without error or incident, and from there the Mistiff knew its way. 2 hours or more after they'd left the siege at the harbour, they reached the Yorhetemic Kesperet. The storm was showing signs of fatigue, as they were, but Pi's voice fairly sang when it announced, "This is it! This is the place where I was born!" The Kesperet in front of them was walled, but the gates were open, swinging in the wind. "Lead on," Gentle said, setting Hussar down. The Mistiff pushed the gate wide and led the way into streets the wind was unveiling before them as it fell, dropping sand underfoot. The streets rose towards the palace, as did almost every street in Isordorex, but the dwellings built upon it were very different from those elsewhere in the city. They stood discreet from one another, tall and burnished, each possessed of a single window that ran from above the door to the eaves, where the structure branched into four overhanging roofs, lending the buildings, when side by side, the look of a stand of petrified trees. In the street in front of the houses were the real thing, trees whose branches still swayed in the dying gusts, like kelp in a tidal pool, their boughs so supple and their tight white blossoms so hardy, the storm had done them no harm. It wasn't until he caught the tremulous look on Pi's face that Gentle realized what a burden of feeling the Mistiff bore, stepping back into its birthplace after the passage of so many years. Having such a short memory, he'd never carried such luggage himself. There were no cherished recollections of childhood rites, no Christmas scenes or lullabies. His grasp of what Pi might be feeling had to be an intellectual construct, and fell, he was sure, well shy of the real thing. "My parents' home," the Mistiff said, "used to be between the Chianculi," he pointed off to its right, where the last remnants of sand-laden gusts still shrouded the distance, "and the hospice," it pointed to its left, a white-walled building.
"So somewhere near," Gentle said.
"I think so," Pi said, clearly pained by the tricks memory was playing.
"Why don't we ask somebody?"
Hussar suggested. Pi acted upon the suggestion instantly, walking over to the nearest house and rapping on the door. There was no reply. It moved next door and tried again. This house was also vacated. Sensing Pi's unease, Gentle took Hussar to join the Mistiff on the third step. The response was the same here, a silence made more palpable by the drop in the wind.
"There's nobody here," Pi said, remarking Gentle knew not simply on the empty houses, but on the whole hushed vista.
The storm was completely exhausted now. People should have been appearing in their doorsteps to brush off the sand and peer at their roofs to see they were still secure. But there was nobody. The elegant streets, laid with such precision, were deserted from end to end.
"Maybe they've all gathered in one place," Gentle suggested. "Is there some kind of assembly place? A church or a senate?"
"The Chianculis, the nearest thing," Pi said, pointing towards a quartet of pale yellow domes set amid trees shaped like cypresses but bearing Prussian blue foliage.
Birds were rising from them into the clearing sky, their shadows the only motion on the streets below.
"What happens at the Chianculi?"
Gentle said as they started towards the domes.
"Ah, in my youth,"
the Mistiff said, attempting a lightness of tone it clearly didn't feel.
"In my youth it was where we had the circuses."
"I didn't know you came from circus stock."
"They weren't like any Fifth Dominion circus," Pi replied. "They were ways we remembered the Dominion we'd been exiled from."
"No clowns and ponies?"
Gentle said.
"No clowns and ponies," Pi replied, and would not be drawn on the subject any further.
Now that they were close to the Chianculi, its scale, and that of the trees surrounding it, became apparent. It was fully 5 stories high, from the ground to the apex of its largest dome. The birds, having made one celebratory circuit of the Kesperet, were now settling in the trees again, chattering like minor birds that had been taught Japanese. Gentle's attention was briefly claimed by the spectacle, only to be grounded again when he heard Pi say,
They're not all dead.
Emerging from between the Prussian blue trees were four of the Mistiff's tribe, negroes wrapped in undyed robes like desert nomads, some folds of which they held between their teeth, covering their lower faces. Nothing about their gait or garments offered any clue to their sex, but they were evidently prepared to oust trespassers, for they came armed with fine silver rods, 3 feet or so in length and held across their hips.
"On no account move or even speak," the Mistiff said to Gentle, as the quartet came within 10 yards of where they stood.
"Why not?"
"This isn't a welcoming party."
"What is it, then?"
"An execution squad."
So saying, the Mistiff raised its hands in front of its chest, palms out. Then, breaking its own edict, it stepped forward, addressing the squad as it did so. The language it spoke was not English, but had about it the same oriental lilt Gentle had heard from the beaks of the settling birds. Perhaps they'd indeed been speaking in their owner's tongue. One of the quartet now let the bitten veil drop, revealing a woman in early middle age, her expression more puzzled than aggressive. Having listened to Pi for a time, she murmured something to the individual at her right, winning only a shaken head by way of response. The squad had continued to approach Pi as it talked, their stride steady. But now, as Gentle heard the syllables Pi, O, Pa appear in the Mistiff's monologue, the woman called a halt. Two more of the veils were dropped, revealing men as finely boned as their leader. One was lightly moustached, but the seeds of sexual ambiguity that blossomed so exquisitely in Pi were visible here. Without further word from the woman, her companion went on to reveal a second ambiguity altogether less attractive. He let one hand drop from the silver rod he carried, and the wind caught it, a ripple passing through its length as though it were made not of steel, but of silk. He lifted it to his mouth and draped it over his tongue. It fell in soft loops from his lips and fingers, still glinting like a blade even though it folded and fluttered. Whether this gesture was a threat or not, Gentle couldn't know. But in response to it, the Mistiff dropped to its knees and indicated with a wave of its hand that Gentle and Hussar should do the same. The child cast a rueful glance in Gentle's direction, looking to him for endorsement. He shrugged and nodded, and they both knelt, though to Gentle's way of thinking this was the last position to adopt in front of an execution squad.
"Get ready to run," he whispered across to Hussar, and she returned a nervous little nod.
The mustachioed man had now begun to address Pi, speaking in the same tongue the Mistiff had used. There was nothing in either his tone or attitude that was particularly threatening, though neither, Gentle knew, were foolproof indications. There was some comfort in the fact of dialogue, however, and at a certain point in the exchange the fourth veil was dropped. Another woman, younger than the leader and altogether less amiable, was taking over the conversation with a more strident tone, waving her ribbon blade in the air inches from Pi's inclined head. Its lethal capacity could not be in doubt. It whistled as it sliced and hummed as it rose again, its motion, for all its ripples, chillingly controlled. When she'd finished talking, the leader apparently ordered them to their feet. Pi obliged, glancing around at Gentle and Hussar to indicate they should do the same.
"Are they going to kill us?"
Hussar murmured. Gentle took her hand.
"No, they're not," he said. "And if they try, I've got a trick or two in my lungs."
"Please, Gentle,"
Pi said. "Don't even—" A word from the squad leader silenced the appeal, and the Mistiff answered the next question directed at it by naming its companions: Hussar Aping and John Fury Zacharias. There then followed another short exchange between the members of the squad, during which time Pi snatched a moment to explain.
"This is a very delicate situation," Pi said.
"I think we've grasped that much.